Hi, my name is Jeff Newman. I'm with Neustar. We're the current registry for .biz and .us, but we're also the technical registry operator for .travel and .tel. And I'm glad, actually, to piggyback on Rob's comment, I'm glad this is the first time that the whole subject of a technical back-end registry operator has ever been brought up. All of the economic studies that have been done before have just blanket said registry and registrar. And in fact, there's also other variations of registrar. There's resellers, which is a whole other market. So for example, if a registry can't be a registrar, in theory, they could be a reseller and still exert that same type of market power. The other point I want to make is, and I'm glad we're talking about facts, because you know, your discussions was all on the academic level. But today, you know, given that new TLDs are coming in a few months, you know, we're debating this issue. But what's going on in the market today is that there is a market for registry operators. And it's not just the existing ones. It's not just Afilias, Neustar, VeriSign. It's a number of them that you see out there with booths. And some of them have pretty nice ones with famous chefs. But there's a lot of them out there. And the things that's going on in the marketplace today, an actual fact, is that if a new TLD operator, a registry, the one that is wants to hold the contract with ICANN, is going and shopping around, and they're getting some of these affiliated back-end operators saying, look, if you use someone else to be your back-end operator and don't use me, then I'm going to charge you all these fees to have my affiliated registrar carry your TLD. They're saying, if you use Afilias, let's say, then we will charge you $200,000 a month. We want an equity stake in your company, and we want a certain fee for every domain name sold, regardless of whether it's our registrar that sells it or not. This is actually going on today. This is not made up. This is going on. And this is something that if we're going to have this new round that starts in 4 months and we're getting in this academic debate, people are spending some real money right now on applying for new TLDs as a registry, as trying to compete for a back-end registry operator. And I'm just worried that the fact that this is all going on today and we're talking in this academic sense, I mean, you know, investors are we're not sure of what to do.
It's a fair comment. It's not the first time that comment has been made at an ICANN meeting about ICANN moving slower than the market. But I mean, I understand the point. It's a very valid comment. What we're trying to do here today is to facilitate a further discussion inside of ICANN so that they can come to an answer. Because I think everybody inside the staff and among the community. The most important thing for you is let's get to an answer, right? Now, you'd rather have the right answer than the wrong answer, obviously, but you got to have an answer because you got a business to run. So that's what we're hoping this will lead to.
I'm Richard Tindall from Enom. And so we agree. We think it's about market power, and we think that's a pretty rare occurrence in this industry. So let me jump to something that Jeff just said. I mean, we are the number two registrar. We're competing to provide back-end registry services to new TLD applicants, and it's a very competitive market. There's a group outside that Jeff just mentioned, Mind the Machines, who have no registrar capability, and they're competing very effectively with us. So I think the occasions of market power are pretty rare. I just wanted to play back what I thought I heard as the three potential anti-competitive effects in sort of general theory. Evade price caps, exclude rivals, and exchange sensitive information. So in the context of the new draft applicant guidebook, we think all three of those potential problems are adequately covered. First, there are not price caps on the TLD, so we don't think that's an issue. There's an equal and open access provision to registrars, so you can't be the only registrar. So we think that is covered. And the data that the registry gets is public data. So we're not really talking about a registry getting access to sensitive information. So just a couple of thoughts quickly about market power again. So we would like to apply for TLDs ourselves. Let's say we apply for .cool. We think that .cool is going to compete with .com and .net. And, you know, we don't think we're going to have market power in that sense. And even if you believe that we're a market unto ourselves, we think there could be a .verycool or a .extracool or a .2cool. So we think that those are going to compete with each other. We don't think we're going to have market power in our TLD. And then finally, market power as a registrar. We're the number two registrar by volume. I got to tell you, it doesn't feel like we've got much market power at all. It's hyper-competitive. Margins are very, very thin. We're always looking at ways to innovate in terms of services and quality. So even as the number two registrar, we're not feeling that powerful.
Just one factual point. 5 years ago, were you the number two registrar?
I think Paul was in his garage.
Well, yeah. So it's just one of the indicia of a competitive market, and it certainly looks like the registrar market has become a very competitive market, is you see changes in the sort of standing of various people. The number one, two, three, four guys don't stay the number one, two, three, four guys. That when you see them staying the same, sometimes that is an indication maybe the market isn't very competitive.
Let me ask you some questions about your lack of market power. Do you charge prices that are higher or lower than your major competitors?
It's Paul Stahura. I'm the founder of Enom. I can answer that one. Lower.
Okay. And do you keep customers over a long period of time, or do you what fraction of your customers do you lose every year, and what fraction? What's your one loss rate for existing customers?
It's probably 75% renewal.
Okay, so you lose 25%, and what fraction of your customer? What's your growth rate? I mean, what's your new customer to existing customer ratio?
I don't know the number off the top of my head, but I know that our registration base is growing at about 10% a year. Okay. This is all public information.
Okay, so yeah, I'm raising these because these are some of the facts that you'd like to know.
I'm with Richard. I wish I had market.
Okay.
Power.
Do your customers feel locked into you that once they buy from you for a couple of years that they can't move?
No, because let me see. Yes. they might feel locked in because we provide superior services.
No, I mean registrants as opposed to the registrants.
No, because it's very liquid. Registrants could easily move. ICANN has been pretty good with implementing transfers from one registrar to another one, and it's really liquid. Registrants move in and out all the time. One other thing about what Jeff said was, there might be some registrars who say, hey, if you use my registrar backend for your TLD, if you don't use it, I'm going to punish you by not offering your TLD on my platform. I never thought of that, even doing that, because I don't think I have market, but I don't think I have the power to do that, okay? But now that apparently some registrars are doing that, I might think about it, because there may be some, what I would guess is, gullible registries out there that might take me up on that deal. What they should say is just say no and call their bluff. So if this potential registry said, no, I'm not going to take you up on that deal, I would bet you that registrar would still offer that TLD.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve DelBianco with NetChoice and also a member of the business constituency here at ICANN. And I'd like to bring the perspective of registrants, those who invest in building and developing a second-level domain name or maybe a whole collection of domain names that they comprise in a business. Because I know, Josh, you've mentioned the importance of exclusive or preferential vertical contracts. But from a registrant's perspective, we are also impacted by, good old-fashioned spite and rivalry, even if it isn't power at all. For instance, an example where a registrar might deny shelf space to an entire top-level domain because they don't want to enrich a competing registrar who's going to make money off of registrations in that TLD. And it's not just a hypothetical example. I'll give you a real example with the .me. Top-level domain. It's a GoDaddy project, and I've noticed that at least a couple of large rival registrars, One&One, for instance, in Melbourne IT, don't even show .me for sale. It's not on the shelf at all, at the 2-foot level or the 10-foot level. And if I'm a registrant in .me, that's suppressing the acquisition of other ME second-level domains, and it's probably also going to affect my traffic. And if I'm trying to build a social networking service, and I want everybody to get a name.me, I'm going to have to try to find ways to get those into people's hands because they're not on everyone's shelves. So it's not always about market power. Sometimes it's about market performance, particularly if ICANN wants to see these new TLDs succeed. And remember that network effects, another economic concept that I didn't hear at all today, network effects would say that efforts to suppress the availability and distribution of a TLD are going to suppress the ability of that TLD to be successful.
Just a brief comment. I don't want to suggest from my presentation on the economic benefits of preferential contracts that this means that these abuses aren't real or don't exist. In fact, I'm not. You're in a much better position to know that they exist than I. But I think as a matter of the economics, there's a pretty strong link in economics, or most economists would say, between market power, competitive intensity, as Steve said, and market performance. This doesn't mean that you don't get these sorts of abuses as part of the competitive process, but it does mean, in terms of the general economic analysis, that the existence of those abuses does not follow from the existence of those abuses favoring a blanket prohibition. You might want to think of sort of these facts matter type rules to target out those instances without losing the harms. That's the trickier. Mm-hmm. That's the trickier nut to crack, if you will.
Look, I want to go a little further on this, and that is that take search, internet search, Google, Yahoo, Bing. There's certainly big network effects there, but I don't think that the antitrust authorities would ever consider a rule that required every website to have search bars for 150 search engines. I mean, you tend to let the market work, and not every search engine gets on every website. You allow competition there rather than having a planned economy.
And this is not a matter of whether the antitrust authorities are concerned with the market performance of a new TLD. It's how ICANN and our community is concerned about it. And I appreciate that you guys are doing the panel. That's helpful. But I would like to ask ICANN staff at some point to tell us when will we next talk about this incredibly important topic, after staff, for instance, has developed some guidelines, because I would look forward to more public and open discussions of this before we finalize the new TLD contracts. Thank you.
Mike.
Thanks, Jeff. Hello. Thank you. My name is Mike Palage, a longtime participant within the ICANN process, currently participate within the registry, business, and the IP constituency. One of the first questions that I'd like to talk about is during the, I believe it was the Cray Report presentation, they were talking about the need for good facts to get good rules. One of the questions I have is, over the years, there's been increased litigation involving certain actions by registrars, cyber squatting, massive cyber squatting in a number of instances. There also have been a number of reports by ICANN, by the Security and Stability Advisory Committee, regarding front-running by registrars. Now, all of these issues or actions harm end users or registrants. And in reading all of the reports, I have not seen any analysis of these potential litigations or other reports where there have been alleged misconducts by registrars that have harmed end registrants. So getting back to good facts make good rules, has this been considered, and do you think these are facts that need to be incorporated into your equation?
I don't see why that has anything to do with this subject. I mean, that's a subject that may well, maybe it deserves attention, but what has it got to do with vertical integration between registrars and registries?
Pardon me?
No, it's not obvious to me, so explain it to me.
Okay, so go ahead.
Now you have a registry, I have this brilliant idea. The market is created by the registrants, right? They create the product. I have this brilliant idea. I'm now sure that if I test if the domain name that belongs to the idea is available, I test it with a registry, sure to be a neutral place. If there's a vertical integrated registrar, I'll test it. It might well be that all of a sudden this name has been sold to a company and I can only get it through an auction. For front running makes easier. It's easier if there's vertical integration.
Well, of course, that assumes that everybody is vertically integrated, right?
Okay.
Don't test it with the guy who's vertically integrated if you're concerned about that. Well, yeah, as you said, you're assuming everybody is vertically integrated.
Okay, so...
the end user knows everything like that. It's impossible. Yeah. You have to take care of the client.
We can only hear people that are on the microphone, so you'll have to stick with Pelage for the moment.
That could be a bad thing. So, Joe, to address your concern here, one of the issues that was really a systemic problem within a broader, I think, GTLD community a number of years ago was tasting, right? And there were a number of people in the registrar side of the market that were, if you will, profiting off of that. And it was the registries that stepped forward. It was PIR with their initial funnel request to halt it, then Newstar and then it was Newstar and affiliates that came forward, and it was that momentum by the registries that helped pave the way for a PDP that resolved really a systemic problem that was really a problem. So in that scenario, I think that vertical segregation, where the registries were actually able to step in and prevent a harm, was an important factor. So again, I'm not going to get into an argument with you. I've learned growing up in Philadelphia, I'm not going to bring a knife to a gunfight with an economist or an antitrust attorney. So I'm going to keep this real simple. That's just my analysis, that I think that separation does serve a function in protecting the end registrants. A second point, and I had raised this with general counsel during the briefing session with the registries, ICANN operates in a global marketplace. Unfortunately, the economist and the data points that we've looked at to date have primarily been U.S.-centric. The lack of sort of other competition authorities, the DG4, looking at the global marketplace in which ICANN operates, I think that again goes to this issue of good facts, good rules. And if we're only looking at U.S. rules as opposed to global rules, I think, again, that's my opinion, that's sort of a non-complete puzzle.
Well, look, that's a fair point in general. I don't think it applies to this discussion because these economics are not bounded by national boundaries. These economics work every place. They don't work just in the United States.
Okay.
These are economic principles that I think you would find accepted by Polish economists and Chinese economists as well as American economists.
Okay, just one final point as far as, again, going back to good facts, good rules. You know, one of the things I've written extensively on this issue regarding the economic analysis was the original Cray report. There was discussion by ICANN staff that it would be available in June of 2008, and then all of a sudden it got delayed, and then we had the final report. With the Charles River, we had the preliminary and then the revised. With the Cray, we kind of never got that preliminary, we never saw it, and then we got a final and nothing else. You know, is there any problem with making that original draft available?
You're asking the wrong guy. Go talk to John Jeffrey.
I'll send him an email. Thank you.
Becky Burr, WilmerHale. I have two quick points. One, on the question of case-by-case analysis, what do you do when the sort of facts on the ground are changing as quickly as they seem to be? The data in the Cray report was from February of 2008, and with the top four registrars, it was 50% of the market. It's now 58% a year later with the top four. Went from 63 to 74 with the top eight. So the facts on the ground are moving pretty quickly, and that seems to me to be an additional gotcha in the case-by-case analysis. The other...
Why don't we take these up one at a time?
Okay.
First of all, it's CRA, it's not Cray.
Sorry, it's the ICANN.
Although I didn't write the report, it is the company I'm associated with. When the facts on the ground are changing, you need to do it case by case. You don't blanket prohibitions when the facts on the ground are changing. It goes the opposite way.
I completely agree with you, but if we did a case by case analysis, it won't be until another year that any new TLDs are around. So it's going to. I mean, I'm completely agreeing with you. It's just much harder.
I agree. It would be much harder, and so you need to be careful that you don't build inflexibilities into the system.
In dynamic industries, which this obviously is one, antitrust is much harder than it is in dealing with, you know, like the steel business, right? I mean, things do change fast. They are changing a lot. And so what you're trying to do when you do antitrust analysis and what you're trying to do when you do economic analysis, you're trying to figure out what is the future going to look like given these various approaches to things. If I do this, what effect will that have? In a dynamic industry, it's a lot harder to tell the answer to that. So your point is a fair point. If you take a snapshot at day one, day 30, the snapshot may be different. And if you set a rule based on day one, day 30, that rule may not be any good anymore. This is a serious problem for ICANN generally. I mean, because ICANN is an organization that doesn't work fast. I mean, that's almost by definition. But so I don't know that I have an answer for
no,
you, but
I, don't think
but
there
I
is
appreciate
an
that there, that
I don't
it's,
think
a,
there's an
it's
answer.
A serious
it's an
problem.
Observation. The other point I want to make is about the changes in status quo producing long-term benefits and also short-term transition costs. I understand that the notion there is that there may be harm to competitors, but they're to competitors, but not to consumers in that situation. But what do you do in a situation where we have a structural rule, basically a rule of ICANN has put players in the market in different places. And so there's not a level playing field. And people have invested for 10 years based on a certain kind of rule. The other thing that you add to that is when you deregulated the airlines, there wasn't the prospect of 1,000 new airlines the next day. So although I read your paper on the way down and I think I understand the difference between, you know, the need for harm to competition and consumers, you have this structural disadvantage that has been built in for the smaller registries that needs to be dealt with at some level.
You mean the smaller existing registries?
The smaller existing registries,
right, who are operating under the vertical separation rule.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it's not clear to me as I sit here that they should be, that they need the say the price caps and vertical separation rules. That you'd want to do an analysis of that as well.
Right. I think there's just another. And on the other side of it, for the past 10 years, they haven't been building a registrar base.
Right.
Because they haven't been permitted to. So I don't know what the answer is. I'm just telling you that short-term, long-term thing is complicated by the facts on the ground again in this situation.
Right. But again, I'm going to state this as a user, not as someone in the community. I mean, you're working for us users. We're not working for you. The rules that ICANN should make should be the ones that are best for the development of the internet. And you know, if it harms some firms and benefits others, well, that's the way competition is. That's the way dynamic competition is.
So, are there situations where that would be, I guess the question is, are there situations where, in fact, there is a structural rule that is the creation, not of the market, but of a regulator that changes the next day, and the people who have been regulated in one way are differently situated from the next?
That always happens. Yes, it is the airlines. I mean, you have United Airlines, American Airlines, saddled with higher legacy costs, and they were disadvantaged relative to the new carriers that didn't have union contracts, American Airlines, United Airlines had the wrong sized planes for the deregulated market, because with deregulation, the airlines started to have these hub-and-spoke systems where the smaller planes made more sense. The older legacy airlines had airplanes that were higher cost, you know, less efficient users of fuel. That's always true in the economy.
Now, you know, that's the right economic answer. Right? That's the right economic. It's not necessarily the right ICANN answer. I mean, this is, you know, we're not trying to be up here to state ICANN policy. Your point is that there are likely, if you make this sudden shift, there are likely to be some dislocations. Right? And those dislocations are going to impact some people worse than others.
And the impact is going to be the product. The differentiated impact is the product of an ICANN rule.
Yeah, and that's all, I think, probably accurate and a fair point. And now it's a policy issue for ICANN to determine what if anything, to do about that.
Right, and I guess my question was just, are there examples in the world where we can look to for that kind of stuff? We can talk about that afterwards.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Adam Palmer. I am policy counsel at .org, the Public Interest Registry. Before I ask my question, though, I wanted to thank you for having read the memo that we produced and that I was instrumental in drafting for PIR. And I wanted to emphasize or just bring to your attention that the emphasis of that document was our support for competition, support for a fair playing field for new GTLDs, and the protection of the 10 years of progress that have been made in promoting competition within the ICANN community, and our concern about a sort of back-to-the-future academic approach that might reverse the progress that's been made in competition. With that said, I did want to make one point bringing up the CRA, I was about to call it CRA, the CRA report that sort of had the notion that registries might perhaps play a bottleneck role in the community and rollout of new GTLDs. But really, I think it's fair to say that the opposite could be true, that in fact right now you have a registrar that's free to place or not place any registry that it might desire to do so. You also have a registry a registrar that might be able to be a back-end service provider. In those cases, we talked about the abuses, and I think those need to be emphasized, that if you're a new GTLD applicant and the registrar is a back-end service provider and has the power to force you or compel you, that if you want shelf space, that you have to use them as your distribution channel, that could be a significant harm to small new GTLD applicants or to small service providers.
So, Adam, could I just ask a question? What's the source of that power? How do they make that happen?
Through market force, by demanding, compelling them to use their services or risk losing that critical shelf space.
How do you know that registrars have market power? What's your evidence that registrars have market power?
I think it's quite clear from the data and inherent within the system.
The
distribution channels, the degree to which one might control distribution within a given GTLD, or the shelf space that they can control. Inherently, if you have certain registrars that control significant amounts of shelf space, they would have greater power and could demand higher prices.
GoDaddy has less than 30% of the shelf space. NSI, from reading your report, has got 7-8% of the shelf space. Are you suggesting that NSI, with 7 or 8% of the shelf space, has market power?
I would still say that there needs to at least be some transparent analysis of this and examination of this outside of this sort of theoretical assumption that maybe they don't have the market power.
Let me just make one point here. Everybody who makes a product that is sold to a retail customer would love to have that product on Walmart's shelf because Walmart is the biggest retailer in the country. Not everybody has their products on Walmart's shelf. Walmart picks and chooses the products that it puts. There's a lot of people out there still living, still viable, still making money who aren't on Walmart shelves. Now, it's possible that GoDaddy or Enom or NSI or somebody has more power vis-a-vis registries than Walmart has vis-a-vis retail products, but on the face of things, it doesn't look like it.
Well, can I ask you just in terms of an affiliated registrar, wouldn't it be natural that they would give priority shelf space to those new GTLD applicants for which they're providing back-end services?
Yes.
And therefore, you'd be foolish not to.
They would have an incentive to do so because they get a share of the profits, and they would actually sell the domain names for the affiliated registry at a lower price, and that's a good thing for registrants. Okay. Second thing, every retailer has private label products, and they sell them for a lower price because they get a bigger piece of the action. And one, that leads to lower prices for consumers, which is a good thing. I want applause again. But more importantly, it does not tend to drive the branded products out of business. And what you're concerned with is that it's going to drive the branded products, the unaffiliated products, out of business. And I think that requires some more analysis. You're saying that I'm being theoretical, but I think you're being theoretical. You're one, making an assumption that the registrars have market power, and you have no evidence of that. And secondly, you say you're so worried that the registrars are going to coerce the registries into providing back office services. But as I talked about before, if the registrars have market power, they can exercise that market power over the registries without the vertical integration. So I'm not sure what the anti-vertical integration rule does under your analysis, other than protect the existing registry infrastructure providers from competition. And that's the question you need to answer. That's an on-the-ground practical question.
If I can add one point on empirics rather than theory, I mean, Joe raised Walmart. One of the areas I do a lot of work on vertical contracts with shelf space in the retail space, right? So I understand there are important factual differences. Most of the research in that area, empirical research looking at effects on price and variety and quality and things that those end users really care about, suggests that and where you've got all the incentives in play with vertical integration into the retail shelf space from the manufacturer, vertical integration with the retailer with the private label, you have all of those same incentives at play, obviously in a very different institutional framework, is that where you've got competition at the downstream level, and you've got folks like Walmart who are large in the retail space, or supermarket chains that are relatively large and probably have shares that approximate about the numbers I've seen in terms of the registrar space, that research essentially shows, and caveat for full disclosure that most of it's by me, that those competition for the shelf space ends up helping the consumers. It lowers prices. It increases product variety. Stores get bigger and nicer and those sorts of things. That's sort of one of the natural predictions of the economics of competition for distribution. I think that obviously the shelf space competition here, there are some similarities and differences, but I think not different enough that it's an irrelevant principle.
Ken.
My name is Ken Stubbs. I have a couple of comments to make. First of all, with reference to a comment you just made, I think there needs to be a significant amount of additional review of some of the data, because there is a term that we use in the industry called net creates. And these are the additions to the existing database. If you take a look at the net creates over the last 2 to 3 years, you find a significant difference in the patterns of who really has market power. So I think that needs to be looked at much more closely, and it was not reviewed as well in the initial report. Also, basically, eliminating a cross-ownership restriction will give registrars access to very sensitive information about their affiliated registries and the registries for which they provide back-end services. The CRA report says that if the registrar registry separation requirements are relaxed, ICANN would need to vigorously enforce the equivalent access and anti-discrimination requirements provisions of the registry agreements, on one hand, including access to competitive sensitive data. But the report also acknowledged that elimination of cross-ownership limits make it very difficult to enforce these safeguards. We know that in the past, enforcement has been a very serious problem with ICANN. We also know that when the contracts were originally written, especially some of the accreditation agreements that were originally written, the enforcement clauses in this agreement made it very, very difficult for ICANN to deal with certain issues because all you had was a death penalty. Now, I am very concerned about just taking somebody's word on it that, don't worry, we'll be nice. You know, we will act properly. And when you have the potential in this new round of abuse on a significantly larger scale than it has been in the past because you've had primarily one segment to deal with. Now you're dealing with, as Jeff pointed out, different segments and different definitions. You have an enforcement problem. You could use the approach that you said, Joe, and that is we got to get something out there. And I'm not paraphrasing you. Please correct me. We've got to do something. The point I'm saying is, do we create a paper-thin dike and we spend the next 5 to 10 years running around plugging holes in these dikes because, quote, we didn't realize that there was a loophole here and a window of opportunity there? I don't necessarily think that's in the best interest of the consumer, in the best interest of stability and security. I do not think it's in the best interest of business and the intellectual property constituency people as well. So that's just the way I feel about it. Thank you. Well,
those are all relevant issues for ICANN to consider, I'm sure. The one that also needs to be put in that equation, and again, thank God I'm not the policy guy here. I don't have to make this decision. But whoever's making this decision has to take into account all those things, but they also have to take into account the very likely consumer benefits that are going to arise from having a lot more choice in the TLD space. Now, if you don't believe there are any consumer benefits, then the balancing test there is pretty easy. If you do believe that there are likely very significant consumer benefits, and I think certainly that's my perception. I think that would be the perception from the sort of general economic perspective. Then you got to balance those things and make some choices here.
Well, I understand what you're saying, and you know full well I was not advocating against expansion in the space. I'm advocating for responsible expansion, and my concerns are strictly related to vertical integration and the problems that could result from that.
No, I understand, and I wasn't as precise as I should have been. When I was talking about benefits, I'm not talking about benefits of new GTLDs. I'm talking about the benefits that could potentially be derived from vertical integration by new GTLDs, which I think are at least theoretically very real.
Hi, my name's Bruce Tonkin. I work for Melbourne IT, and I've been involved in the policy development process at ICANN for a while. ICANN is an industry self-regulatory body, essentially. Rules get set, including registries, registrars, ISPs, business users, non-commercial users, etc. So there's two aspects of it. There's a role for setting the rules, and there's a role for enforcing the rules. I've chaired two different policy development processes that have come up with a different answer. One process was transfers to make competition easier. And in that case, we set some very detailed rules about how to do transfers. And if you think about it, we had the expertise to do that. And ICANN also enforces those transfer rules. And you know, we have a compliance department that focuses on that. Another area that we set some rules was in approving new registry services. And at the time, there was a lot of litigation going on. And the question is, did we have rules about assessing whether new registry services would cause a competition problem or not, or would we leave those rules to someone else? The decision in that case was to say that if we post for public comment a new registry service, the industry can respond to that and say whether they think there's an issue or not. But ICANN itself doesn't rule on whether there's a competition issue. What ICANN has decided to do there is to refer it to an external competition body. Now, in that case, we're not setting the rules, but the only thing we've done, and we're not enforcing the rules really either, because all we've been doing is a referral. So we're doing neither of those two things. We're not setting the rules, and we're not enforcing them. A position that might be somewhere in between there, and I see this happening in Australia a bit, and I know in Australia we have a competition body called the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission. They don't directly, have enforcement powers on their own. What they do is they actually take a private company to court, and then the court resolves or makes a determination based on the law. So I'm just wondering, a possible situation for ICANN here is to say, well, do we really have the skills to write the rules? I'm not sure that we do, other than perhaps being overly simplistic and making them really simple, saying there is no vertical integration, and then we try and define all the loopholes around that. Or we say, actually, we don't really know how to write these rules. We'll use some other rule body. Let's say US law and Australian law and Europe law. But is it enough for us just to refer it to one of those bodies when we think there's a problem? That's a bit I have concerns with, because in many cases those bodies prioritise their cases. And it could be that this isn't, you know, it might be a big issue for me as a registrar or a big issue for someone who's a registree, but a government body set up to regulate things might say, yeah, that might be an issue, but I've got this huge issue with telecommunications, or I've got this huge issue with the airline industry. So maybe ICANN's role there is to actually be the body that takes them to court. So it's not just a referral, just like, hey, go and have a look at this. It's ICANN actually would take that complaint before a court and then get the court to resolve. So those are options. But my question for you is, are there other examples of industry bodies that you know that are industry self-regulatory to do some degree of rule setting, but where they're actually taking an approach of literally taking people to court using the laws of the country versus trying to set their own laws or set their own rules? I want to get your perspective on that balance.
I'm not aware of an example of that. Bruce, are you guys?
Yeah, no, I don't know whether, under U.S. antitrust law, I don't know whether ICANN would have standing.
Yeah, the issue would be in different jurisdictions there'd be standing issues, and then the rules might vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction.
They would, yeah.
And so I'm not sure that's a workable. I mean, I see what the rationale for it is, but I'm just not sure that's a workable solution. It's an interesting thought, but I think it's complicated.
You know, you could, if you wanted to, you could set up your own little antitrust jurisprudence based on the European Commission jurisprudence, or the U.S. or Australia, or anywhere else. You could set up a Bureau of Competition with lawyers that would prosecute cases.
Yeah, just think more lawyers than ICANN.
Yeah,
wouldn't that be
right.
A wonderful thing?
Yeah. So I guess what I'm focusing on is really the enforcement piece, if you like, rather than the rule setting piece. And because
right.
A lot of people are concerned in the past, ICANN has seemed to be fairly weak in enforcement in many
right.
areas. So
right.
yeah, I think that's
I mean, certainly one possibility would be that you would just, if you will, delegate this whole issue to national competition authorities,
which is what they've done with registry services.
And
you're certainly
right that you would be a prisoner of their priorities if you did that.
That's the issue, I think. And then the speed. And so what happens is, because we're a prisoner of those priorities, once someone starts breaking the rules, someone else says, that's good, I'll start breaking the rules too, and you lose control of it.
Okay. Unfortunately, I know there's other people that want to talk, and perhaps Steve and Josh can stay here and talk, but we're going to have to end the meeting now because I have to go someplace else. John?
Yeah. The suggestion is that if we could take written questions, we can actually provide them to the panel and ask them to reply formally. Would that work for everyone that's still in the queue?
Will that result in a working group or something like that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it'll at least result in making a public record of the questions and responses to them. And then we can also make sure that the rest of this is appropriately placed so we
But any of the rest of you who want to try to attack these guys on the way out, feel free.
Yeah, I know you have to go, but couldn't you let someone else moderate and stay for another half hour? There are like 5 to 6 people here, and these gentlemen are here. I mean, we've got people sitting in the room. I think it's only fair to keep these guys to stand for half an hour.
You know, I defer to the ICANN staff on that.
So we're being encouraged to end this because we've gone significantly over and there are many other programs that are going on. It's not that we want to cut off this dialogue. In fact, this is fantastic, but I think we could move this dialogue to a written form. Nancy, can we keep the room for a little while or do we... There we go. So we just got another half an hour. But it's also
Good.
Up to the two guys left on the stage if they want to stay.
Yeah, they'll do it. And either they can moderate themselves or, John, you can step up and do it. But
sure.
I have to leave. Thanks.
All right, so we're going to go for one half hour, but if anybody else joins the queue or we can't get through the queue, we're going to have to take written questions. Okay?
Is it me?
Okay. Go for it.
Great, thanks. Paul Foody, ours sold. I understand from Kurt Pritz today that as it currently stands, ICANN does not know how many new GTLDs they're going to be permitting. They don't know how many the system can support. Given that, you talk about ease of entry into a market. I was watching the cricket today, the 2020, India versus Pakistan, and Pakistan won. And all around the adverts were single word, Yahoo, it was all one company. There is no .com anymore. And as soon as organizations, corporations are given the right to buy their own GTLD, that's going to be it. The top 1,000 corporations are going to have, they're going to buy up the internet. That's going to close off the internet to every other competitor, although that their only recourse is going to be to get a secondary domain, a .com, a .net, a .google, a .whatever it might be. How is that good for competition?
Why, if the 1,000 corporations would each have their own TLD, why would that kill the other ones?
That's exactly the comment that people used 20 years ago when I was working in the commercial property business, and they were resisting applications for supermarkets. Today, the British food industry is dominated by these. By the supermarkets
That's because the mom and pop stores couldn't compete. They had high prices. They had very high prices. Their food tended to spoil. Are you really saying that we shouldn't have permitted supermarket chains?
What I'm saying is that competition is what you are basing the Dennis Carlton report supported the new GTLDs on the grounds that this encourages competition. If only the top 1,000 corporations are able to get effective domains that they can advertise effectively around sporting venues, everyone else is just fighting for the crumbs.
And you don't think the fact that there'd be would these 1,000 TLDs also have other people having domain names in them, or would they all be corporate proprietary?
If I was the likes of Yahoo and Microsoft, I wouldn't let anyone else on my site, would you?
Well, that's what Yahoo does now. They have a search engine. They let everybody on. Same with Google.
Well, sorry, I mean Apple. All these organizations that are single product, Coca-Cola, Pepsi.
Just opened up.
Sorry?
Apple opened up. They used to be closed, but now they're open. And in general, when there's network effects, there's a benefit from opening up. That's why VHS beat Betamax. That's why Microsoft beat Apple. I don't think you'd get 1,000 closed TLDs. That's not what I would predict.
I'm predicting 10,000 if you're allowed 10,000, and they will all be closed.
And these 160 million other people that want to have domain names, they would just not
tough.
Be able to get domain names?
Well, they'd be able to get domain names, but they'd be, buying them in the secondary locations in exactly the same way as only the big retailers get the prime spots on any high street in the UK. Everyone else fights for space on the secondary locations. Thank you.
I might speak briefly before Tim, because I'm going to say something he might want to respond to. I'm Dan Warner. I previously was with Fabulous.com, which is around the 12th or 13th largest registrar, until about 2 weeks ago. Now I'm with Interweaving.com. Now, I would say that regulators and regulation is actually much more closely aligned with communism than it is with capitalism. And the reason for that, and it's not that I don't think the regulation has a reason to exist, I just think it tends to overcomplicate things. One of the problems is that if for free markets to really work, you need flexibility, commerciality, and agility. And regulation tends to do exactly the opposite of that. The more you regulate something, the more you increase the size of a tax system until you have four books that you can't even lift in order to create taxes that people don't understand anymore, just like regulation in the domain space. You actually gain a lot of inefficiency, and you spend more time administrating and actually competing. Competition is hindered by a lack of simplicity and a lack of flexibility. And in that, I can even complicate it a little bit, because a lot of what you've been looking at is in the sense of, is there competition in the registration space? Now, I'm a strategist, not an economist, and I'm certainly not a regulator, but as a strategist and having worked for Fabulous, where I look at a lot of different things, you have three major groups, of course, which is the registries, registrars, and registrants. Now, in registrants, there's professional domain owners, and some of them own hundreds of thousands of domains, and they can be quite powerful in themselves. You have the registries, and you have, like, GoDaddy, and GoDaddy actually does have a very dominant share of the market, and you say 35% isn't a lot, but if you look at the retail market and the consumer mind share, and if you start to bring in particular, all the things that are involved in this space, and you take it and say, this isn't about registration. Actually, most of the money isn't in registration, and that's largely because through distortion of overregulation in some ways, it's actually forced the businesses to say, all right, well, I'm going to make my money in web hosting, which tends to be the most profitable sector. And so you end up with doing packaging deals and things. You get this domain. Like in Germany, they give you 10 domains, I think, for free, but you're paying for the web hosting. Right? I may be wrong on that. Any Germans in the room, I apologize. So,
it actually costs money to register.de.
Okay, good. That's fine. But anyway, what I'm saying is it's actually a very a complex market, and there's transfer pricing between different products that you have. If ICANN thinks it's regulating the price of domains, it's kidding itself, right? It's just not the way the market works. The point that I really want to make and what I want to really ask your opinion on is that if you simplified all the rules and you took out all of this, how are we going to regulate every single point in the process and every single way that anyone sells anything, when you have a hybrid combination of completely unregulated markets like hosting and registrations, why can't you actually, what's wrong with competition? What's wrong if someone comes up with .shop and they only want to sell, they want to be the registrar, and they want to be the web hosting company, and they want to be the registry. They want to do all of that, and they want to sell at $1,000 a piece, or $2,000, $5,000. In an open market, when they don't have any dominance of competition, what's wrong with that? .com is the 10,000-pound gorilla. Everything else is superfluous, right? If you look at the retail market, GoDaddy, which I really like as a company, by the way, is a hugely dominant player in the retail market. And if you, in particular, when you look at where do they stand in the world when it comes to hosting plus registration plus these other services and mind share with the consumers, they have a hugely dominant share. If you look at Enom, Enom's a reseller provider. They're actually distributing. They don't really have that central brand. They're distributing all of their mind share throughout their distribution network, and they're an enabler rather than a competitor in that sense. So comparing Enom against GoDaddy and how they're actually intercompeting is really not that helpful. So how do we actually eliminate regulation instead of increasing regulation? How do we open the market for flexibility, agility, and commercialization?
Well, interestingly, you're making the argument for regulation by saying that GoDaddy's got a lot of market power.
Absolutely not, because that's simplistic. I'm saying at the top end of the market, when if you take a collection of all these things, hosting, registration, registry services, registries, if you take all those things and you get players that are too big and they have too much market power collectively, they need to be regulated. If you leave the rest of the market alone and make that tax system a 10-page book, you will end up with an efficient system where the market is the market, and commerce actually rules. Do you have a differing opinion to that, or is it?
I'm not sure I heard a question.
Well, do you believe that we should simplify the system to be?
Sorry, can we wrap up the question?
Okay. Can we simplify the system to be nothing more than ensuring that dominance doesn't occur and over too much market power for only the top players?
Sure. I think some of that is consistent with the general economic analysis we went through. I mean, you can think of some really simple rules, right? You can have a complete ban and ban the vertical contracts as well. You can have a per se legality rule and let whatever happens happen. And maybe you want to carve out some exceptions for .com and sort of treat that differently. You can have simple rules. The economic point is that simple rules are going to lead to either under-inclusive or over-inclusive results. Now, the fact that there are these anti-competitive, potential anti-competitive effects that would lead from one result, or that you would throw out the pro-competitive virtues with a complete ban, follows pretty straightforwardly from the economic analysis. Now, for the point about simplicity versus administrative costs, right? So on the spectrum, you have these two simple rules, and you can think of case-by-case analysis in the middle. And you might think, and this is a question for I can't determine, not economists, you might think that the administrative costs of doing that case-by-case analysis are something that you don't want to bear, or that are too high relative to the gains, and instead want to adopt a simple rule or maybe delegate to antitrust authorities. And antitrust, for example, the challenge for antitrust authorities over the last 100 years has been how to struggle with the same exact question, how to embrace the case-by-case analysis because you need the facts to identify the bad instances, but still give businesses some clarity and certainty about what they're allowed to do and not allowed to do. And so in antitrust, you'll see some combination usually of some standards that are very fact-intensive coupled with some very bright line rules, right? So if you don't have market power in antitrust, you can't violate the U.S. antitrust law.
But when you only are really regulating when people trigger that regulation, when you become too big and you're becoming so big and powerful that you're anti-competitive, if you left the rest of the market to be the market, what economic reasons are there that you cannot do that? I mean, what's the...
None.
Okay, thanks. Just wondered.
Let's go on to the next question, Tim.
Tim Ruiz with GoDaddy. I'm not going to comment about our market power. I just smile big when I hear things like that. I started with GoDaddy when we were number 181 out of 185 registrars, so it's kind of exciting. But I guess I have more of a concern that I'd like to express than a question, and you can respond to it as you like. But I think the issues that have been raised today, some of them are new. Some of them are things that we really haven't spoke out about publicly since this whole issue came up. And it's very clear to me, you know, that this is a very complex issue, and I really appreciate the advice that simplistic solutions are going to ensure mistakes. And so my concern is that as we move forward, if we think that somehow we can stick to the existing timeline and really fully address this issue and not make those serious mistakes, I think we're really fooling ourselves. And it seems to me that there's really a choice, that we either need to rethink this timeline, push it out, maybe not even have a timeline until we get some of these problems resolved, or pull this back. Let's go with the status quo for this first round and then address this issue appropriately, give it the time it needs so that we can really discuss it and vet it, and then think about it rolling something like this out perhaps in the next round. But I really discourage us from just creating policy on the fly and doing it hurriedly because we want to get the new GTLD process out. Now, we give this the time it really deserves.
So do you charge higher prices than your competitors?
Absolutely.
Would you contribute data to be analyzed by to calculate revenue-based market shares?
Brian?
Brian Q with Affilius. Back early in the conversation, there was a suggestion that there might be different types of treatment for registrars who had market power versus registrars that don't have market power, both with respect to registrars but also registries. Have there been any systematic analyses of market power for registrars or registries that you're aware of, or any that ICANN has conducted, since the Cray report did not go into that in great detail? And that's question one. Question two, and then I'll step away. I assume you've heard some new inputs today that you didn't know before in terms of back-end registry services being one element of this, of CCTLDs and reseller channels. What are the indicia that you guys would look to discern market power, given some of the inputs you've gotten today? And one last statement. I'm not sure that's been made clear by some, that in terms of the status quo, there is a status quo structure with registries and registrars, and there's some vertical constraints. It's not clear that if the status quo were to remain, that some of the potential abuses wouldn't flow from that anyway, because the status quo actually has an absence of certain safeguards. Can you comment on all three of those, please?
With respect to the first question about, I mean, I've seen the studies that are publicly available, so I've seen, I guess, what you've seen. And out of those studies, with respect to any definitive studies of market power at either level, I mean, I've seen data on shares and the like, and I think one of the points that's come out of both Steve's analysis and mine is that when you want to calculate a market power analysis, when you want to engage in a market power analysis, whether you're talking about the registrar or registry level, you want to be focusing on the competitive dynamics. And I think some of your second question blends into this, right? So some of these new inputs might be really important to consider, the reseller channel being one, for instance. Ken had the comment earlier about maybe there being a difference in registrar shares, whether we were thinking about current or historic. You might think that the more recent ones are sort of a more important indicia for how you calculate shares, which let me say the following. I mean, shares themselves are an imperfect way to conduct this analysis. There are industries where shares are not a great proxy for market power, and there are things like Steve has mentioned throughout with respect to pricing behavior and other indicia that would be important. I mean, neither Steve nor I has conducted that analysis, and in part, my understanding is that there are some real data limitations in doing that.
And you've spoken, if you don't mind, spoken a great deal about shelf space and the research that you've done. Are there other industries or we could use as a reference for identifying certain indicia that would be useful in this space?
Yeah, the indicia, the general indicia, we can give you a list. We could refer you to the European Commission merger guidelines or the U.S. merger guidelines. The general indicia are things like market power is all about substitution and barriers to entry. So you want to know whether registrants feel that it's easy to substitute among registrars or whether they feel locked in to particular registrars. You want to know whether some registrars charge higher prices for the same quality of service. You'd like to know about price cost margins and profitability. You'd like to know about market shares, not market shares that's sort of in the whole universe of the sort that's been published in the various reports, but you'd also like to consider narrower possible markets, like a corporate market versus a consumer market. So, you know, a whole host of variables that you would look at. And I guess I would say from, you know, the work I've done that, no, there hasn't been a really good study done of market power at the registrar level, which I think, you know, ICANN's been focused on market power at the registry level, but what's come out in this whole discussion about vertical integration has been a concern about market power at the registrar level and, you know, at the infrastructure provider level. At the registry level, I'm personally inclined to think, and I'm stating those words carefully because it's no more than an inclination, but I'm inclined to think that .com has market power, but frankly, no one's done that study in a rigorous way either. I mean, I tend to think that, you know, .com, as fast as they're growing, if they'd raised the price up to $500 per domain registration, that would probably be profitable, that people would feel locked in at least for a while. But, geez, at $500 a pop for 3 or 4 years, that would, even if they died after that, it would probably make enough money to make it profitable. But that's at the level of the study. I mean, but that would be the sort of thing you'd do with .com. And, you know, there's a price ceiling for .com. But, you know, do I think that .biz could do that? That it would be worth it for .biz to raise their price to $100, and sacrifice the potential growth? Probably not.
There's very creative people in this room. You want to be careful about what you suggest.
John, I'm terribly sorry. We do need to close this meeting. I know it's very important, if you don't mind.
Well, you did tell me I had 30 minutes, and there's still 6 minutes left and two questions.
You can do it in 6 minutes. Otherwise, the doors will open, and I'll have to start moving chairs. Thank you. Quickly, please.
So let's ask quick questions and see if we can get them in.
Yeah, so am I going? Okay, one quick question and one quick comment. I'll do them both together, and then you can answer. That's me. Yes, not John Nevitt. Oh, yes. Other John up there. The quick question is, so it's been mentioned that slotting fees are often have a good effect for consumers. Are there situations in which slotting fees are harmful to consumers? Just looking around briefly, it looked like there were at least some cases in the U.S. With McCormick that the FTC at least had concluded that slotting fees had been used in an uncompetitive ways. And I was wondering if you could provide more light as to how that might happen, so we might consider that in our discussion. And I just did want to briefly mention, though, despite that question, that there's been a lot of discussion today about whether or not forcing access by registries or limiting access between registries and registrars is helpful. I worked for a small registry for a while, and certainly in our view was it would have been really helpful to be able to create our own market in order to innovate and create new products that registrars weren't used to selling today. Certainly didn't want to force it on anyone else. And so I think in both cases, having regulations that would force registrars to carry our product, it probably wouldn't have been fair, but at the same time, being able to just offer the product on our own as opposed to being forced to go through a channel that wasn't particularly interested in selling our product would have been really helpful too. So I'm going to agree with previous commentators who say that a low sets of regulations for new entrants would be really helpful, I think.
Let me answer your question very, very quickly. With respect to the slotting contracts, the McCormick case you cite was about slotting contracts in the spice industry in the U.S. and was a consent decree between McCormick and the FTC rather than a fully litigated decision. There's been no real analysis. There was no real analysis in that decision about the ultimate competitive effects. I don't mean that to suggest that they weren't anti-competitive. They may have been, but I would not say that that sort of substitutes for the type of rigorous analysis you would want to inform your policymaking. That said, there are a number of cases in the U.S. involving competition for shelf space where real competitive concerns are raised. I don't think McCormick's a particularly great example, but things you worry about in most of those cases in the U.S. involve all things equal, longer-term contracts, years, longer-term contracts, although that's not a necessary condition for competitive harm. But in terms of sort of dispositive studies, the FTC took out a several-year study on slotting contracts and essentially reached no conclusions. That was largely because of data limitations. They asked very nicely if companies would like to give them their slotting data, and the company said no. I would refer you on the empirical evidence. There's one of the articles cited up on those bullets on the slide. We'll point you to essentially all the evidence there is on slotting if you're interested.
I would just add, I'm a little more hawkish than Josh on slotting fees, but if you want to have a good example of exclusion from retail distribution, I think you can look at Windows tying Internet Explorer. That would be a good place to start.
Last question.
Markus Frey, I'm with Core Council of Registrars. One quick information on Germany's .de domain names. They are much cheaper than .com, and there's no 7% price increase. But let me start by saying that CORE is, in the absence of a better model, all for registry-registrar separation. But I concur with Michael Pelage that the solutions that we're looking at are many times done with US-centric thinking. Take, for example, as I'm wearing this nice T-shirt of a 2002 Ghana meeting, take, for example, a TLD that targets the market in Ghana, say a .accra for the capital of Ghana. There's no ICANN-accredited registrar in Ghana, so there's only two in the whole of Africa. So what you have to do as a registry, in absence of the possibility to have your own registrar, you have to go to a US registrar on bended knees and ask them to offer the possibility to register your .accra, and you have to tell the people in your country to go to the US and register a domain name. Probably they have to pay by credit card, which might not be a favorable payment system in Ghana. So there's no simple solutions here. We at CORE have some solutions, and we're happy to work with staff and to offer those solutions. So my question here is, how do we get in contact? Or the offer is for anyone of ICANN staff present, grab me or one of my colleagues to discuss this topic.
We'll certainly do that. Thank you. So did either of you want to respond to that at all? If not, thank you so much for taking your time, your extra time, and coming in and answering these questions. And thank you to everyone who stayed for the whole program. We'll make sure that there's a great transcript of this. We'll help make sure it's all ironed out. And any additional comments that anyone has that they'd like to add to the record, please let us know, and we'll do that.
All right, the hotel houseman, if you don't mind, I will pick up the paper. If you can start moving the chairs, I will pick up the paper. You start moving the chairs. Thank you.